Speaking of Liberty, we'll be back next week with a new episode. This week, we are bringing you the full interview with Representative David Lewis of Harnett County. In this interview, we discuss issues ranging from electoral reform to the growing cannabis and hemp industry in North Carolina, as well as the rural healthcare situation in Harnett County. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did. There were some issues with the audio recording at the beginning, so we are going to jump right into the interview halfway into Representative Lewis's answer to why he is seeking re-election to North Carolina's General Assembly in 2018.
People's main interest in certain regulations is their job depends on it, and their board is paid by fees, or their job is to regulate X industry, so that's all they're really concerned with. And I think we need to take a much broader approach at that. I also see so many needs in the field of how we educate our kids. Very proud right now to be leading a task force that the speaker named dealing with school safety. And I kind of look at it as Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, you've got to feel safe and secure. You got to have that need met before any other needs can be met. So I would like to see us invest in more school resource officers and more hardened, if you will, physical school properties to protect our kids, but I also would like to try to prevent some of this by keeping people more well mentally and physically. I think we need to invest in more school counselors. I think we need to invest in more school psychologists. I think the opportunity to share those exists. And I'm very, very passionate about expanding broadband to the more rural parts of our state. A survey was released today and it showed a great amount of North Carolina technically having access to broadband. But the truth is, the way that report works, if any home in a certain census tract has broadband, they count the whole census tract as having access to high speed, and that's not the case. I'm very passionate about trying to expand high speed. I see that as the next frontier, just like leaders in the last century focused on expanding water and sewer and roads. I think that broadband is our next frontier, and I'm willing to do whatever we have to do to tear down walls to get that built. I understand that the private companies have to make a return on their investment, and I want them to. There ought to be some way that we can provide a path forward that they can return money to their stockholders and meet their obligations while at the same time being able to serve underserved areas. I think, you know, a low or no interest loan, or perhaps actually putting the infrastructure in and selling it back to them, might be a way to do it. But if you don't have access to the internet these days, you are really at a severe disadvantage in every social, educational, economic playing field there is. You can't apply for jobs. You can't search for good jobs. You can't take classes online to build your skill set. You can't search for news. I mean, you are really and truly left behind. And counties like mine, there are huge patches of our county that just don't have any access whatsoever because the phone lines that were put in decades and decades ago aren't sufficient to carry the load, and cable hasn't been run. I mean, you know, the reason that satellite companies thrive is not necessarily they have the best product, although some would argue they do, and I'm not getting into that. It's because cable doesn't run everywhere, and everywhere that cable runs, there's also usually the opportunity to have high-speed internet. So those are three of the things that I'd like to see done.
You talk about wanting to reduce the income tax. There's other states where they've been able to abolish the income tax and rely solely on sales taxes and what we would call sin taxes in order to fund their governments. Is that something that the legislature is interested in? And if so, have they discussed it? But if not, what do you think is holding them back?
The legislature is certainly interested in doing away with the income tax if they can. But you have to understand that well over half our entire revenue for the state comes from the income tax. So you're talking about trying to use other kinds of taxes to backfill $10 to $12 billion. And we've tried to look at it, and what it means is that you have to severely increase the sales tax rate on items. You have to greatly expand the base at which you tax. You have to tax food. I think we have a pretty good balance now. A lot of the other states that, or the states that have been able to do that, don't necessarily carry as much of the same statewide financial obligations as our state does. You know, everybody wants to talk about the level of funding that we do for education and where it ranks nationally and this, that, and the other. But the fact is, education is a very complicated thing. It has three main funding streams: the state, the local government, and the federal government. And I can only speak for what the state does. And I can tell you that it is absolutely factual that North Carolina ranks between 10 and 12th overall in the amount of money that our state spends per student. We also have second only to Texas in the number of state maintained roads that we have. You know, I used to have a little business down in South Carolina, and you'd go to pay your property tax every year, and right there on your property tax bill, it would say county road fee. And the roads are nowhere near as good in South Carolina or in Tennessee or in Georgia as they are here in our state. So I say all that to say that our state, through the taxation of its citizen, shoulders more of the burden for what our citizens depend on every day than many other states do.
The thing that you're most famous for, most well known for, would be your role in doing all the redistricting. So I have a whole series of questions about that we've reached out to membership and asked, what do you want to know? So how would you describe the role that you played both in the 2011 map and in the 2017?
In the 2011 map, I was very new to the process. I tried my best. I'm not a lawyer. I tried my best to understand the law. I tried to understand what was required of us, and I tried to apply that law. There are a lot of things that I did in 2011 that, frankly, I wish I hadn't had to do. The 12th district, for instance, when I first found out I was going to be redistricting chair, I remember talking to then Speaker Tillis, and we were all going to slay the dragon. We're all going to get rid of the 12th. It was just an embarrassment. Well, as I began to do my work to prepare for this role, I realized that the 12th district was probably the most litigated district in the entire United States. And so we felt like if we kept the 12th district, it would maybe isolate our state from lawsuits. I was wrong about that. The lawsuits came, but, you know, I would have done that a little bit differently in the retrospect of being able to benefit from hindsight. In 2016 and ultimately 2017, I was a little more experienced and a little more versed in what was going to be expected. And frankly, I'm very proud of the 2016 congressional maps that we drew. I know that I have been quoted and quoted accurately on numerous news shows where they talk about me saying that it's to maintain a 10-3 Republican map. But the reason, in large part, I said that is if I hadn't have said that, I would have been accused of not telling the entire truth. I could have easily said that it was to maintain the current membership of the House or give the incumbents of the U.S. House a chance. But folks would have found politics in whatever I did. They were going to accuse me of that. The fact is, if you follow traditional redistricting principles, keep as many counties whole as you can, keep as many precincts whole as you can, keep as many cities whole as you can, because they vote together kind of as a cohesive block or a community of interest. If you do all those things first, there still come a time where you have to make a decision, okay, because of one person, one vote, the line needs to go somewhere. And all I've ever told my constituents is I'm going to apply the law and I'm going to follow the criteria that makes sense, you know, trying to keep counties whole, trying to keep precincts whole, keep cities whole, one person, one vote. But with the little bit of discretion that we have in drawing the maps, I will view it through a partisan lens. And that's just the way it is. I could claim, like many in government do, that they could somehow view it without their own partisan biases. I don't think that's possible. I think our political inclinations affects every part of our decision making. And I think it affects it whether or not we're cognizant of it and willing to admit it or not.
Well, on that topic, how would you then describe what being a Republican means to you, or whether why are you a Republican?
I am a Republican because my understanding of Republicans is that we are absolutely committed to providing equality of opportunity for everybody. We are committed to as level as possible of a playing field to where everyone has the opportunity to use their talents and use their skills to develop as fully and as to rise as high as they possibly can. But also, if your choices or your decisions lead you down a different path, we think you ought to also endure the result of those bad decisions. So, in my opinion, the Republican Party is very much about freedom. It's about freedom of opportunity. I compare that with what I think my friends on the other major party have, which I think they see or they seek oftentimes freedom of equality of outcome. They want everybody to kind of wind up in the same place, or those that have more give more, which that's just kind of the way our system works. But again, you know, it's Republicans that believe that you should be able to kind of think and act and do and live as you want to. You know, we are very strong on private property rights. We are very strong on free speech rights. We're very strong on various things. So when it came time to decide which political party I was going to enter, it was, I was a child of the 70s. I was a child of seeing the gas lines. I was a child of seeing the U.S. flag burned overseas by countries that I knew we were helping with tons and tons of financial aid. And I would be inaccurate and less than full of candor if I said that that didn't have a bearing on it as well. I saw, while I think he was a fine man from everything I've read, I saw President Carter is very weak. I think he made our country look weak. And so as I came of age, President Reagan was somebody who I saw was elected as a Republican, went in, did what he said he was going to do, did the things I believed he should do, which is to, you know, try to cut taxes and on the national level, try to restore our international reputation. I think he succeeded in that. So just the visual cues and the things that I learned from watching President Reagan versus President Carter, I think also had a pretty big bearing in why I chose the party that I did.
So would it be fair to say, before you mentioned that everybody would have some sort of partisan bias, whether or not they want to acknowledge it. So would that be fair to say that you don't believe nonpartisan behavior to be possible?
I believe absolutely that it is possible for individuals, not only possible, but it's required of individuals, to follow the law. But I believe that there are certain points in our life and our careers where decisions don't have the benefit of being dictated by law, precedent, or tradition, and discretion has to be used. I'm simply saying that especially when you draw maps, but with many other things, your own partisan view will kick in and will color how you see the policy outcome.
There have been suggestions, though, even in other legislators, the Iowa plan, for example, where they have worked into their law allowing for a nonpartisan, an independent redistricting committee. And we've had bills like this introduced in the House in North Carolina, too. I want to say it was HB 200 that never went past committee, which is always one of those mysterious deaths that, people would be really interested to know why it wasn't given consideration.
The Iowa model is very interesting. I have a lot of people that advocate the Iowa model to me. And one of the things they say is that you want independent redistricting because it leads to greater participation. Well, I can tell you that in 2016, Iowa had roughly the same percentage of uncontested legislative seats as North Carolina. So I think that is largely misproven. I also believe that, frankly, it is easier to draw districts in Iowa. People laugh when I say this, but if you look at the map, you'll see that I'm telling the truth. Iowa's a square state with square counties, and Iowa has never been subject to Section 5, the preclearance of the Voting Rights Act. Now, based on the recent Supreme Court decisions, we don't believe that race should be taken into account when drawing districts, but it was required to be taken into account in 2011. I'll also say, and I'm vaguely familiar with Iowa, not as much as you because I haven't been there as much, but I will tell you that North Carolina is very unique in that we have a handful of heavily populated urban centers that, I mean, if you take Wake and Mecklenburg County combined, you've got two out of every 10 people that live in this state. If you add Durham and Forsyth and Guilford, you're getting on up there to nearly half of our population that live in just a handful of counties. In fact, I think you'll find that 70% of our population live in 15 counties. Well, that's important because our entire system of government is and always has been based on a system of drawing districts. Again, we got to try to respect counties. You got to try to respect cities. Got to try to keep precinct whole. Iowa doesn't necessarily have that. Doesn't, I mean, you know, certainly they have at least one heavily populated urban center, but ours is, our state's very different from Iowa. I also have found that the redistricting process is going to be a process where whichever entity, and that includes mine, that doesn't feel that they were fairly treated or had gained some kind of advantage is going to go to court. And having worked with our staff here in the legislature, I just don't believe that delegating the responsibility that's ultimately going to wind up in court and making these professional people who make a career out of working up here defend something in court against a highly partisan charge that's certain to come from one side or the other is the best way to proceed. So I would say that I can literally go down and look at the various groups that are calling for nonpartisan redistricting now, or bipartisan, or whatever they want to call it. And I can show you that they absolutely have political leanings through other expressions of their group's priorities. So it's very hard for me to take serious that these groups that clearly have, most of them, that clearly have a political philosophy that I consider very democratic, very much to the left, if you want to use the vernacular we use up here, that they somehow now, after the Republicans have the majority, now they want to change the way the lines are drawn. North Carolina lines are drawn in such a way largely because our urban centers, which are heavily populated, have a lot of people, but they don't have a lot of land mass. So the problem that the other side has with the districts is that you can't draw but so many districts in and around Wake County and Mecklenburg County and Guilford County because the majority of our state is red. I know everybody who's listening to this podcast now recalls maps going back to Bush versus Gore, which shows this huge map of the U.S. Every precinct that went for Bush was red, and every precinct that went for Gore was blue, and the red was just overwhelming. You do the exact same thing in our state here. The bulk of our state has a population that is inclined towards the conservatives and towards the Republicans, and the metro areas, which is a minority of the state's area in terms of land, but certainly a huge part of its population, tends to vote other way. So our state is just very unique in that way, and I would say that it continues to trend that way. I think when we see the 2021 census, I don't think anything will have changed in terms of the way the people that live in geographic areas vote. But I think you will see that Wake County and Mecklenburg County and the bigger urban counties have gained a much larger share of the political clout in the state.
So if I understand you correctly, it sounds like what you're saying is the groups that we do have, Common Cause, for example, that are purportedly nonpartisan in their advocacy, you believe that they are an example of the idea that they're not, there's no such thing as truly nonpartisan, that you always have some sort of leanings.
I think that is absolutely what I was trying to say.
Then my only question there would be, I mean, I can't think of any other way to say, well, what about libertarians? In North Carolina, we don't make a differentiation between major party and minor party. And prior to the passage of Bill 656, which we'll discuss more a little bit later, we're subject to all of the same rules, and had to go through quite a bit to make sure to maintain ballot access. So even though it is a small proportion of the population, that is a grouping that can't necessarily be said to obviously have some sort of Republican or Democratic bias.
That's absolutely true. And first of all, I like libertarians. Most of the policy positions they take, I agree with. I will tell you that libertarians are relevant in the conversation when it comes to drawing districts, because in areas where libertarians garner votes, those votes are not going to one of the two other major political parties. And so if we are grouping precincts, and again, you group precincts within a county, they all need to be congruent. They need to touch. They need to be compact. You don't need to have one that stretches, you know, further across the county than it needs to. But when you group the precincts, they have to fall in some order. And if you look at the, you can't consider race. The courts have told us that. Fine. I'm glad we've got to a point where we don't have to consider race anymore. But again, if you look at small towns in Wake County, you look at Apex and Fuquay and Holly Springs, those towns tend to vote Republican. And so grouping them together seems to be a natural fit, if you will. The libertarians come into account in so much as if there's a strong area that tends to vote libertarian, then we certainly recognize those results, and that could very much influence if precinct A or precinct B goes in a district. Because again, all of the things being equal, and nothing's ever exactly equal in terms of population, things like that, but let's just say you have precinct A that has 5,000 people in it and precinct B that has 5,000 people in it, and you've got to put precinct A, you have to put precinct A or precinct B in district 12, let's just say. I know if I put precinct A in district 12, that the Democrats likely to prevail. All of the rules are followed. Everything's fine. If I put precinct B in district 12, the Republicans likely to prevail. But I have to make a decision. So I just tell folks up front, when I followed all the laws and I've made all the required decisions that I have to make, when I look at the discretion, I will view it through a Republican lens. I think if a libertarian were drawing the lines, they would do probably the same thing.
Do you think that that would not be maybe a less distortionary lens, at least? There's a lot of laws, for example, in North Carolina that we have that are specifically and intentionally designed to be bipartisan, which I always like to point out to people is very different than nonpartisan. I mean, just general human nature says you make better decisions when you have three people in the room rather than two, because you become less adversarial. You have an opportunity to take different perspectives. Why would that not be something that could be useful even in this in redistricting? If, you know, if we're not to believe in nonpartisan, at least should we shy away from bipartisan, which, I mean, there's plenty of states that have bipartisan gerrymanders. It just means that it's not competitive for anyone.
Right. I certainly don't object to as many opinions in the room as possible. I think while we get almost no credit for it, I think we are very open. We hold public input. We try to respond to it. It's very frustrating, to be candid with you, when we'll go back to 2016. A court stepped in and started on a Friday afternoon, started the clock on Friday at the Friday afternoon before Valentine's Day, I believe, and said, you have 2 weeks to redraw the lines. Now, before, it had taken us 6 months. They gave us 2 weeks. Before, we got criticized because we took public input before we put out the maps and then after we put out the maps. So I tried to produce a map. I put it out there and I asked the people, I said, please come in and give me your advice on how to make these maps better. And a lot of the suggestions that we got in that end, we took. But instead of doing that, you had Common Calls and other people who were going to go to court anyway, fill the room and take hours upon hours upon hours of saying, we need nonpartisan redistricting and you shouldn't draw the maps and you're a racist and a fascist and every other kind of name that they could call me. And that was their right. And I wasn't angry with them. But what they did is they took their 3 minutes or their 5 minutes or whatever they had, and they were asked a question, how would you improve the maps? And they didn't answer the question. They railed against the process. So after a while, you just get tired of those that rail against the process and don't engage.
Well, now I'm going to push back on asking more about the process then. There were very specific parts of the process that were brought up and criticized. The fact that you didn't take race into account, which you've clarified before that you previously were required to take it into account. But then once the courts intervened and ruled it a racial gerrymander in order to prevent it from being race, you took race out of the equation, but you still kept partisanship in. And the kind of like elephant in the room question for me is that nobody seems to want to ask is, do you feel that there is any overlap now between partisanship and race that can't necessarily be ignored?
I struggle with that because I don't really know the answer. I know from everything that I see in news articles and just empirical evidence on the ground that it does appear that African Americans tend to vote Democratic. But the percentage of Democratic vote in a predominantly African-American precinct is really no more than the percentage of a vote for the Democrats in heavily white but heavily rich precincts in downtown Raleigh. So I don't know. I certainly don't believe that while African-Americans have every right to point out that they have not been dealt a fair hand in much of the history of this country, and that they are oftentimes wrongly discriminated against based on the pigmentation of their skin, I don't think that Democrats can claim that. I don't think that a Democrat can claim that they are denied access to a loan to buy a house or denied access to participation in anything because of the pigmentation of their voter registration card. So I would push back and say that our critics who have figured out that African Americans, unfortunately, are still more likely to vote for Democrats than Republicans, although I hope we can change that at some point, want to use that in a way to elect more Democrats under some kind of crazy theory that they believe electing more Democrats is better for blacks. I think that I'm not black. I don't have the perspective of being black. And I frankly think it's silly and naive when people that look like me try to understand what it's like to be black. But I think it, were I black, I think it would offend me that people thought they always knew what was better for me, what was best for me. So I absolutely reject that being black and being a Democrat are the same things. I absolutely reject that being black and facing racial obstacles is equivalent to being a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian or a Green or whatever else you are and facing political opposition. I think those are totally different things.
One of the things that you just said there, I wanted to just have a moment to have you clarify on. You said that you believe it's naive sometimes for white men like you to try to understand the experience of a black person. Now, I would take that to mean that, you know, you can only understand it through secondhand. But that, to me, begs the question of what do you do to try to understand perspectives that you simply can't understand because you haven't lived them?
All we can do is go and read what the law is, what the law told us, and we'll go back to 2011. What the law told us is that if there was evidence of racially polarized voting, see, that's something we can measure. Racially polarized voting is where you have clear evidence that it is likely that the voters of one race stick together and vote. They vote for the people of their race and against the people of or the candidates of the other race. This state, through your tax dollars, spent tens of thousands of dollars analyzing and having reports made, studying if racially polarized voting still exists in North Carolina. I will tell you, and it's public record, in the trial in Greensboro, Representative G.K. Butterfield testified that he thought racially polarized voting still existed, and he thought that any district that was drawn in eastern North Carolina that was below 47% African American would not elect an African American. So in 2011, being a white man, I tried to apply the law as it existed and as I understood it. We knew that we were facing what was called Section 5 preclearance, which is where the U.S. Department of Justice under Eric Holder would review our plans, and if our plans in any way took away voting opportunities or opportunities to elect the candidate of their choice for African Americans, they were going to reject our plans. And they didn't reject our plans because our plans follow the law. What changed, you may ask? What changed is that we have a court system, and the plaintiffs continued to sue. They found a sympathetic judge who said that he actually wrote that he did not find any malintent on the legislature's part, but that we did not fully justify that there was racially polarized voting in this state, which means we should not have used race. We freely acknowledged that we used race because we thought that's what we were supposed to do. So we had to redraw the maps. He gave us 2 weeks. Nobody presented any evidence more than we already had about racially polarized voting, which, again, the judge had already rejected. So we did not consider race. If you don't have evidence that racially polarized voting exists, in other words, that people vote for or against candidates based on their skin color, then you can't consider race. And so we didn't.
So I want to just kind of backtrack for a second to House Bill 200. I feel like we didn't get a very clear answer on it. This bill was sponsored by 39 different House members. But it never got out of committee and was never given a hearing on the floor. Is there any specific reason why a bill with that much initial support never got past its first committee?
House Bill 200 is the bill that is favored by Common Cause, which has a lawsuit against the General Assembly and against me in my official capacity. I think it is naive to think that there are people out there who have no political interest, who want to give their time to draw maps that are purely political because they exist for the purpose of electing candidates. I think it is a flawed policy. I think many of the people that are on that bill are on that bill because it is politically palatable to say, I'm for nonpartisan redistricting. And you have to understand, I'm a politician too. It'd be easy as heck for me to go around and say, hey, I'm all for nonpartisan redistricting. And I used to believe that it might be possible to do. But based on my own experiences in life, I do not believe it is possible to take an inherently political function like drawing legislative districts and take the political aspect out of it.
So kind of just shifting gears a little bit towards the electoral reform that the House and Senate have both been really working on. One bill that really is popular among libertarians is Senate Bill 656, which lowered the bar for ballot access. It's pretty much the only reason that the Green Party is having an opportunity to be a party in North Carolina. But right at the last moment, the Republicans tagged on a provision that canceled the 2018 judicial primaries. And it was a bill that had a lot of support and reasonably could have passed unanimously with bipartisan support if it hadn't been for that provision, which destroyed the support that it did have.
It would take a long time to go through the statistics with you. So I'll simply say that the districts that were drawn for district and superior court judges over the years haven't been changed in about 60 years, largely 60 years. There have been a few added, but they haven't really been changed. They haven't been adjusted for populations. We have areas of the state where taxpayer dollars are still paying for three superior court judges, whereas the population really would justify one. Those superior court judges ought to be moved to the counties that need them. Counties like mine that need more assistant district attorneys or more district court judges, because that's where the population growth is. So with the idea that we needed to take a look at redoing the judicial districts, we elected to cancel the judicial primary simply because if a person may have been planning on running for Superior Court judge in Bertie County, for instance, which has lost a lot of population, or Martin County, which has lost a lot of population, and their district essentially went away, not because they were bad people or bad judges or bad anything, but it was the seat was needed somewhere else. We wanted them to have the opportunity to run for, you know, they might want to run for the Court of Appeals or run for the North Carolina Supreme Court. So we felt like you had to treat all the judicial officers the same. We got to judicial redistricting a little bit later in the session than we had hoped to, which is a shame. That bill itself, dealing with the judicial redistricting, has probably been talked about and vetted and heard and discussed in committee as much as any bill that we've ever considered in my entire tenure up here. It's still being discussed, still being changed. We've not pushed back on nearly any request to modify the map. So I say that when the speaker made the decision that, yeah, we probably ought to look at judicial redistricting or some other way, and he's very clear about that, or some other way to reallocate judicial resources where they're needed and out of areas. There's areas in the state that have multiple judges that only hold court one day a week because they don't have enough work. But when we tried to fix that, it all became because it fit the narrative that the other side wanted to advance and the narrative that, frankly, many in the press wanted to advance. that we were somehow evil and gerrymandering and trying to cook the books, it fit their narrative to say that it was a bad thing to do. And I think that's extremely unfortunate. I don't know. We may very well restore the judicial primaries, especially if there's not a whole lot of changes in the districts. But you also have to understand what else we were dealing with. We were also dealing with the fact that at the time, Governor Cooper had not named the Board of Elections. So a lot of the decisions that needed to be made about when an election would be held and things like that, there was no board to make it. So sometimes you take a shot in the dark and try to do the best you can. And I'm not sure, frankly, that canceling the judicial primaries was the best thing to have done, because we may not even get the districts changed now. I mean, time is really starting to run short. But at the time we had to make the decision, we live in such a world that we were concerned that if we didn't go ahead and cancel the filing and move it to June, if we let it get closer to filing, that somebody would bring a lawsuit claiming that we had taken something away from them. We had taken away some kind of inherent right to run for some seat. So we just wanted to make, we were trying to again forestall lawsuits and failed at that, because there's a lawsuit filed against the canceling of the primary. So it seems logical to me, if you're going to look at redoing judicial districts, most judges are elected by district. I realize the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court are not elected by district, but there may be good judges who are not going to have a district to run in who may have wanted to run for those seats. Again, we didn't want to be accused of denying them the chance to run. All you can do is make the decisions that you have with the information that you have before you. It's unfortunate to me that my friends on the other side of the aisle were so concerned that there was some kind of trickery going on that they failed to even realize that for years, their own courts commission and their own Democrat-led entity said there needs to be a reallocation of judicial resources to match changes in the population.
What I was trying to get at with this question was almost more of a mechanics of legislation. Why tack it on to a bill that was popular until you tacked on this additional provision? Why not present it in its own bill?
I think that's a fair question. I think it's a matter of opinion. I think there are many members up here who would prefer to vote on every single issue that we deal with as an individual bill. In this case, we elected to put it on a bill that, as we call it, quote unquote, has legs. The bill had already passed one chamber. There was a chance to modify it and get it passed into law faster. Now, I'm not always saying faster is better, because sometimes we go too fast up here trying to pass bills. But in this case, we had a bill that had come over from the Senate. We were able to modify it in the House. We had full committee discussion in the House, full committee discussion on the House floor. And then it went back to the Senate. They reviewed it and agreed. Would it have added much more time if we'd introduced another bill? No, frankly, it wouldn't. But it probably would have added 3, 4, 5 more days to the process. And at that time that the bill you ask about was passed, we were running up against the clock where people were going to start to consider whether or not they were going to file for office.
Within electoral reform, we kind of get back to that issue of bipartisanship not being the same as nonpartisanship. Because one of the things that stands out to me is in the laws that we have that refer specifically to bipartisanship, they identify the first largest voting group by or party by registration and the second by registration, which puts North Carolina in this kind of cute situation where our second largest voting group is unaffiliated. Just even amongst unaffiliated, you know, people tend to have a lean one way or the other. And you would assume in North Carolina, because we have such a strong Republican legislature, that a lot of them lean more Republican. But why is there not more of an effort to bring that group into the process? So the Board of Elections specifically, in trying to make changes to the bill to make it more palatable, essentially to the governor, the legislature added in one seat for either an unaffiliated or a libertarian voter, which seemed to highlight for a lot of people one of the problems with that, which is that it is a board of people who are selected by and for policing of the parties, but not necessarily representative of the electorate.
I think that's a fair point, and I don't really know how to fix that. There is no unified voice that speaks for the unaffiliated voter. I think that it would be very helpful, and more of these type reforms that you mentioned would happen if we could have more participation in primaries. I think if you look at the dismal participation in primaries across the state for every single race, you will find that it is only the hardcore that vote in primaries that selects who's going to go forward. So you have to make a choice between this person and that. Now, I think I actually appeal to voters on both sides of the aisle. I think I treat members on both sides of the aisle with respect and work well with them. But we have some districts that are heavily Democratic or heavily Republican simply because of the way they exist. In other words, you're not going to elect a Republican in Durham County. Doesn't matter what you do. You're just not going to do it. So we send those people who are chosen in a primary by a very small percentage of the voters who are registered the same way they are. We send them to Raleigh or we send them to D.C. and we expect them to work together. They don't even speak the same language. It's kind of funny. Senator Rucho and I actually in 2011 thought we were making some of the districts less Republican or less Democratic so that the primaries wouldn't play quite as big a role. But it didn't work. Still, people just don't show up. They don't vote. They don't participate. If you don't show up and participate when the first decision is made, then your choices are radically limited when the second decision is made.
What else does the legislature have going forward then? We have a lot of electoral reform still continuing. You've discussed that you're still possibly working on changing the maps. But what else is important and on the House's agenda, at least?
Well, one of the things that is most personally hurtful to me as a human being is that there are some people out there who believe that I don't want huge percentages of our population to participate in the process. And that's simply not true. I have said from the very first day that I started working on electoral reforms that I wanted every single person who was eligible to vote to be fully able to exercise that right. There are things that don't make sense to me. If we allow out-of-precinct voting, for instance, now if I were a skeptic, I would say out-of-precinct voting is the most ripe for fraud because people literally can sit around and look and see who doesn't vote and go to those precincts and cast their ballot in those people's names. But the reason I think out-of-precinct voting is really, really bad is, one, we give 17 days for people to go to the one-stop sites and they can vote any election in their county. But if you go, for instance, let's use two precincts, for instance. If you're registered in Black River and you live in West Davisboro, and you go to the Black River precinct on election day, they have to let you vote. But the problem is they don't have the correct ballot. So your franchise, your opportunity to vote for county commissioner that represents you in West Davisboro, school board in West Davisboro, state house for that matter in West Davisboro, you're denied that chance to vote all because you went to the wrong precinct. Would have made so much more sense to go in one of the 17 days of early voting, because early voting sites have every ballot in the county, or just go to your home precinct and vote, or take advantage of the no-excuse mail-in votes that North Carolina offers that many states don't. There's no excuse for not being able to vote the ballot that you were meant to vote in this state. So we said, let's do away with this out-of-precinct voting because, yes, the opportunity for fraud is there, but also it denies people the right to vote for certain people that actually represent them. And third, to be candid, it is a real pain for the election officials because the votes have to be counted by hand. The opportunity for human error if they look at it, and maybe you win County Commissioner District 2, but School Board District 3, and they misinterpreted that, your vote might not count then either. When if you'd have just voted on the right ballot, your vote would have counted. People say that we were against early voting. That's not true. We expanded early voting. There were more early voting sites than ever before under the plan that we put forth in the election of 2016. So I think you will see us continue to work. I do think that there is still considerable concern about making sure people are who they say they are when they vote. I think you're going to continue to see an effort to have some kind of a photo ID implemented. I think you're going to see us try to make more sense out of this out-of-precinct stuff. And, you know, I want people to register and vote. And if we can figure out a way to make people register and vote, to make that easier, to, you know, we've already put the form online where you can download it. But think about this scenario. If you want to commit fraud, you show up the Saturday before the election with a Duke power bill that you printed on your LaserJet printer and a Harnett County water bill that you printed on your LaserJet printer. And you walk in and you say, my name is John Smith and I live at 16 West Jones Street. Right here is my power and my water bill. They've got to let you register and vote that day. The following Tuesday is election day. By the time the voter verification happens, your vote has been counted and the election has been certified, even if they can't verify who you are. Exponentially higher percentage of people that register one stop are never verified than those that are registered through the traditional ways. I don't think it's unreasonable to work as hard as you can to make sure everybody who's eligible gets to vote, but to also make sure that those votes aren't diluted by those who shouldn't have voted or who may have voted more than one time.
I recognize the concern about there being the potential for abuse there, but is there evidence of abuse? That seems to be one of the major pushbacks, is that this is a proactive rather than reactive solution to a problem that may or may not exist.
I don't know how you would prove the problem existed or didn't exist when you can't ask for the IDs. I also know that if you want to commit fraud, the opportunity is there. I think if you look at the British Commission on Election Integrity, which is the only reason I cite that, is it's the most recent one. It came out in 2015, but you can go all the way back to the Carter Bacon, which was President Carter and President Carter and James Baker report. They both say the same thing. Politicians have the biggest incentive to cheat because they want to win. And if the field is ripe enough to allow them to cheat, the incentive is certainly there to do it. So why not do all you can to protect the people and make sure their voice is heard by cutting back on the amount of cheating that could go on? It's important to understand, too, we didn't take, if you forgot your ID or didn't have it, you could still vote. Just a little bit higher level review. Had to sign that affidavit saying, hey, I am who I say I am. So you have to think about it. All it did is make it a little bit harder to cheat. Didn't deny a single person the right to vote. And that's the funny thing about this. I choose to say funny because I don't want to say it makes me angry, because what good would that do? Nobody has yet been able to say they were denied the right to vote under the voter ID law.
Harnett County has terrible healthcare prices, specifically on the exchange. My husband and I are both 26 this year, so we had the fun experience of trying to shop for our own health coverage, which I've checked in years prior, but this was the first year that we were subject to the law. And the prices in Harnett County, to say ridiculous is an understatement. I mean, I think when I did the math, I figured out that based on the prices that we were quoted for our family of two people, both healthy 26-year-olds, we would not fall within the realm of the law until we made $100,000 a year, because the ACA has a provision in it that says if the cheapest plan available in your area on the exchange is more than, I think it's 8 or 8.5% of your AGI, then you're just not subject to the law, no penalty, go figure it out. And that's where a lot of families are in Harnett County. And this is something that rural counties too have issues with, is because of the lack of access to affordable health care, one of the few ways that you can get access is through Medicaid. And it really provides a very strong incentive to not make money in order to maintain healthcare, especially for young mothers with children who that's their only option. Is if they make just a little bit too much, they're going to lose their healthcare, even if they might still be able to get their kid covered.
We have serious problems. I have been supporting a version of healthcare for working families and people on the lower end of the earning scale, perhaps. Many of my colleagues have a plan that they call Carolina Cares. I have my own version of a plan that I call Workforce Health Insurance, which is good insurance that will require working people to pay in, but it will be a reasonable amount. It'll be an amount that people can afford, just like we can provide good, safe, clean, accessible housing to lower income people, just like the McKinley Courts we just opened in Coates. There's one in Lillington as well. The name escapes me at the moment. We can provide health care in the same way. People want to participate. I fully believe, and I don't know anything about your financial situation, but I fully believe that you are more than willing to contribute to being a well person. And we have got to find a way that the scales can tip towards people who need help, exactly like what you're talking about. I think you will see more and more conversation on a plan that provides health care, health coverage to people who otherwise can't get it. We were talking to a lady just last week. She clerks at a gas station on Cumberland Avenue in Dunn, and she called me and I went and talked to her. She said, "I don't make enough money to pay for health insurance. I can show it to you," exactly what you just said. She said, "But I got this penalty on my taxes. So I got to figure out how to pay this penalty. But if I didn't have this penalty, I might be able to afford to pay the health insurance now." So we're trying to help her work through this. It is a terrible, terrible mess. Only thing that I can say that I think the Affordable Care Act was successful at is letting people know how much health care costs. And healthcare cost is extremely high. We just constantly go back and forth on who's going to pay for it. The better way to move forward is to find some way to create a primary care doctor system where especially folks like you, younger people, will be able to go in as they need to and get the treatment and the examinations and the blood work and everything else to, in order to stay well. It costs so much less to keep people well than to treat them when they're sick. And the models are out there to make that work. The ability to be able to pay a doctor to see X number of patients, whatever the best practices are for healthcare. You create these centers, pay the doctors help keep the folks well. Cost overall go down. Visits to the ER go down. Visits to the ER for behavioral health issues. We visited the hospital in Whiteville the other day, and literally half of their emergency rooms have now been converted into nothing more than holding cells with 24-hour attendance for mentally ill people because there's nowhere else for them to go. And I don't have any problem. In fact, I support those mentally ill people getting the help they need. But what happens in this state is we take them to the emergency room. They sit there for anywhere from 30 hours to 30 days. They finally get into an institution that can help them. They get to functioning better. They get to be on a better path. They finish their program and we put them out on the street. And there's no follow-up. There's no ability. You know, if you're a psychiatrist, I love Dunn. That's where I live. But if you're a psychiatrist, and you have a choice to live in Dunn or Raleigh, you're going to live in Raleigh. And oftentimes transportation issues, work issues prevent people that live in small rural communities from getting the kind of help that they need. So I think we can change the model and continue to change the model to one of trying to keep people well. There are several, you mentioned bipartisan earlier, there are several strong bipartisan proposals that are floating out there now that I think will help people exactly in the situation that you're in and that many people that contact my office every day are in. And I'm going to keep pushing till we get there.
One of the things that you mentioned is actually part of the solution that my family ended up getting in order to kind of patch together some sort of healthcare, which would be a direct primary care model. But the provider that we actually contract with is still all the way up in Durham. Just it's more convenient by where I work, but that's because the closest one to Anger is over in Moore County. Then there are also things that the legislature could potentially do to kind of ease those burdens. And I'm just interested in if there's anything that you guys have discussed amongst your colleagues. Particularly in rural areas, nurse practitioners have shown to be a really huge support, particularly in primary care. But in North Carolina, nurse practitioners are required to contract with a supervising physician who in a lot of cases provides nothing more than essentially paperwork oversight in order to be able to set up practice at all. And the populations that this disproportionately impacts are exactly those that, you know, we always try and talk about helping. It's maternity care especially, because midwives are almost always nurse midwives. And in North Carolina, home births are generally almost not even an option, because I know the last time that I checked, it came back to an issue with this law where in order for nurses to be nurse midwives who, you know, are nurse practitioners under the law to be able to practice, they have to have a physician who's willing to sign on. But that is also providing competition to the hospitals and the obstetricians. So it's kind of become the situation where the licensure is being used more to protect the scope of practice of another profession. Is that anything that the General Assembly has discussed as far as reform? I know there have been a couple of bills brought up even over the last few sessions, but they haven't really gone anywhere.
We talk about it literally almost every day. I want to figure out some way to make healthcare more accessible to more people in more places. The problem with expanding the scope of practice for great healthcare providers who aren't fully trained is the reason you have the supervisory requirement is there are certain things in certain medical needs that exceed one level of training and move up to the next, and then move up to the next, and move up to the next. I'm very concerned about taking away the safety net of knowing that when you go and see a provider, that you are seeing a provider that has all the training they need to diagnose what's wrong with you. I tell you, I often take my kids, if they get sick on a Saturday afternoon or whatever, I take them up to the little Minute Clinic at the CVS and on McGee's Crossroads. And I've been pleased with that. But to my kids, and to many people who go, that nurse practitioner that sits in there is a doctor. I think she does a very good job, frankly. But she is not trained as much or as well as a general practitioner doctor. A general practitioner doctor is not trained as much as a surgeon. A surgeon's not trained as much, perhaps, as a neurosurgeon. And I'm not trying to say that I think nurse practitioners are trying to do brain surgery or anything like that. I'm just saying that the general public perception is that when they go to see a healthcare provider, they are making the assumption that they are seeing someone who has all the training needed to diagnose and prescribe a treatment and a cure for whatever ails them. And in many cases, nurse practitioners and PAs have that, but in other cases, they don't. And I don't think we have a uniform enough standard to figure out exactly what that is yet. I mean, the only folks really that seem to be the most upset about this, frankly, are PAs or nurse practitioners that would like to practice on their own without the oversight responsibility. But I know that the urgent care in my hometown of Dunn is owned by a PA. The PA employs a physician who technically oversees their medical work. I just don't see how legislatively, through the halls of Jones Street, empowering people to do things that they were not necessarily trained to do solves a problem.
Well, I think my question there would be, you have the ability to limit their scope, though, and you within that noted specifically areas where nurse practitioners and PAs, or not even necessarily PAs, but nurse practitioners who, you know, have almost the same level of education. It's just through a different track. There's still a master's program. A lot of times is a PhD program involved, but the focus on their work tends to be in those specific areas where we have this kind of dearth of care in particularly rural counties. So I guess what concerns me in your response there is, it sounds like you would say that no care is better than care that is not comprehensive. So we don't require doctors to contract with their specialists just in case they encounter something which they have to go, I'm sorry, this is beyond my skill level, I need to refer you up to someone else. Then why is that justified in regards to nurse practitioners, particularly when they practice in the area that doctors don't want to? I mean, we have less general practitioners because of that reason.
Well, I think the premise of your question began with, why don't you simply define the scope of their practice? And I think that's what we've done. Is everything always up for review? Of course it is. I just have not been able to see yet that the stroke of a pen up here solves the problem. I think there's a whole lot better ways. I think loan forgiveness programs to get more doctors who will go to underserved areas is a good way to go. I think that perhaps housing incentives and things like that. You know, one idea that I had, especially in the northeastern North Carolina, I'm sure there's a doctor somewhere in Baltimore or Philadelphia who would love to come down and spend a few months in a more rural setting and enjoy that. So let's buy them a house and let them live there and serve the community. I think that we can make that happen. And to the second part of what you said, I think you really are not necessarily seeing the difference between a general practitioner who is trained to diagnose what's going on and a specialist who's per se designed to treat it. The reason a specialist doesn't supervise a general practitioner is that it's believed in this state, and I'm not a doctor, not a lawyer, it's believed in the state there's a certain level of training required to be able to truly diagnose what's wrong with a person. And I think that you go to a general practitioner doctor if the need exceeds what the doctor can do, or oftentimes the doctor will recognize what the problem is, but realize it's going to require a specialist to treat it. They make the referral and the person goes. Again, I think that nurse practitioners, PAs, play an important part in our healthcare system. I just am growing more and more tired of the constant scope of practice conversations. I don't necessarily believe people in the General Assembly are qualified to always make these changes. I think we have medical boards and medical schools and certain level of expectations.
Do you think that those boards are subject to bias, though, like we discussed before? I mean, in this case, the Nursing Licensure Board is overseen by doctors. I mean, there has to be some sort of bias there when making recommendations on should we expand the scope of practice, which would then cut into what we can claim for ourselves.
Right. Yes, I think that there are biases in everything that is done. At the same time, somewhere there's a group of people, the American Medical Association, who have made distinctions of what it takes to be a doctor, what it takes to be a nurse, what it takes to be a physician's assistant, what it takes to be a surgeon. And in the General Assembly here, trying to use the political process to change what those scopes are, it's just not something I'm comfortable with.
One of the first times that we met for, but we briefly discussed cannabis reform. We discussed that it's a great cash crop. And you said, well, you know, if it was legal, then I might even consider growing it.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, we do have legal hemp in North Carolina. It's really been a great cash crop and has even started producing, you know, a CBD industry, which I know the legislature has also struggled with how or if to regulate. But seeing the way that it has panned out with just hemp, which feeds right into North Carolina's textural markets, do you have any thoughts on how that would extend then to cannabis, either medically or recreationally, and how that might impact the tax base if you are able to legalize and tax that cannabis?
I have spent a lot of hours trying to better understand cannabinoid science. I am convinced that there are medicinal benefits to certain applications that involve cannabis-related products, and I would like to try to move the ball forward. Part of the obstacle to moving the ball forward is a lot of the advocates who support moving the ball forward take an all-or-nothing approach. They want, you know, free recreational marijuana use or nothing. And that's just not usually the way this place works up here. We go in incremental changes. I would take issue only slightly with a couple of things that you said. I'm excited that we're growing cannabis now. I'm excited that the state of North Carolina, I do believe CBD oil, I've seen the almost miracle effect it has on kids that are having seizures and things like that. But it's not without fraud. We're having difficulty getting the seeds to grow it. We're having difficulty farmers grow an entire crop, and for whatever reason, the levels of the intoxicant part of it are too high and the whole crop has to be destroyed. So I don't think we've got all the kinks out of that yet. I met with Commissioner Steve Troxler 2 or 3 weeks ago. Commissioner Troxler has been a real champion in this. I mean, he has helped bring in seeds and help farmers get going at what could be ultimately be cost to himself. I mean, it's technically against federal law right now to bring in those seeds. And I think the federal government needs to either go ahead and let the states have their individual policies, which pretty much under the President Obama's administration, that's the approach they took. But it's still the federal law. So it's very hard. I mean, you take a man like Commissioner Troxler, who only wants farming to succeed. He wants farmers to grow something. And you've got him signing his name to get cannabis seeds that are technically against the law to bring in, to try to comply with the state law. It's crazy. So I have worked on this. Every time we try to get steam going, it seems like the advocates, and there's a lot of needy advocates, a lot of people who I believe cannabis is helping them stay alive, and it breaks my heart. I've cried in this office with people before because I can't help it. But until we take a scientific approach to it and really look at it, and until the federal government can make up its mind if it's for it or against it, it's still just a terribly heavy lift. The first time we talked about it, I frankly didn't know how heavy the lift was going to be because I have worked on it and worked on it and worked on it, but it has not been a clear path forward so far.
If you had a magic wand and you could either change, abolish, or create any one law, don't have to deal with, you know, writing out the legalese, you could just go, this is the effect that this law is going to have, what would you do?
There are so many things that I would like to do that this is a very hard question, and I don't think I've ever been asked this particular question before. I don't know what law or rule it is that has allowed generational poverty to continue to grow in this country, in this state, and in my county, to where we're now 3 or 4 generations of people who don't know anything but being poor. They don't see any economic opportunity. They don't see any way to live up to their potential because they don't know what their potential is. Whatever it is that has allowed the destruction of hope and the destruction of freedom of opportunity for so many people, I wish I could fix that. I wish there was some way to go back in time or to at least draw the line and say not one more child will have to grow up not being able to eat the food they need, get the clothes they need, get the medicine they need, bathe when they need to, have the educational opportunities they need to. Because I really believe the root of most of our problems in this country are because generational poverty has become accepted, and not being able to be a full member of society has lowered people's own personal expectations to the point that they don't even know it's an issue. And I don't you know, if you were to pin me down, I might go back to LBJ's Great Society, but I don't even want to try to assign blame anymore. I just want to stop it. I mean, anybody that's listening to this, I'd encourage you just to do what you can. Go to your local high school and proctor when they have to give the exams. Go volunteer to help be a reading tutor. If you're good at math, go be a math tutor. Help with the, you know, we have responsibility as human beings. Help with the backpack lunches. You know, a lot of the civic clubs or churches sponsor backpack lunches. There's a lot of kids in Harnett County and across the state that leave school on Friday, and the last hot meal they get was probably at 10:30 that morning when they had lunch at their school. We've got to find a way to, you know, it's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If we can find a way to give true personal and emotional security to these kids and adults who are living so far below their potential, then we can make a difference.
Well, thank you for taking some time to talk to us.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate what you do. I think the first time we met, I thanked you for caring enough to be involved. I echo those statements today. I admire people who commit and work and see a better tomorrow. Our definitions and our meaning collectively in society may not always be the same of what's better, but anybody that's willing to work for something that they see is better, I respect and I appreciate. So I'm honored that you asked to let me have some time with you today.
Well, thanks.